I'm going to make you all cope the rest of the afternoon. And that is, how do we cope with extreme events and some of the strategies for agriculture. And I'm just going to start off by saying that we're going to focus on a couple different things as we go along in this whole piece of the puzzle. And we'll start off with these extreme weather events that are out there. And we talk about temperature, hot, cold, precipitation, too much, too little. And if you look at it from that perspective, it's how do we begin to really look at this system from a perspective in different ways. But I'm not going to talk about soil erosion. As an adaptation strategy relative to precipitation events, cover the soil, maintain the crop cover that's out there, reduce the erosion, and we can solve the problems relative to an adaptation strategy that will prevent the erosion pieces of it. And so that piece of the puzzle is relatively clear on how do we go about doing this. But if we look at strategies that we want to think about for temperature and excessive moisture or drought relative to cropping systems, and I'll even throw in a few animal systems along the way, is if we do really step back and look at this, is that agriculture is constantly and has constantly adapted to all the things that go on. In fact, in a paper that Don Duveck wrote just before he died, he said, you know, that about half of our yield increase has come from genetics. The other half has come from management. And it's really that management piece, and even some of the genetic piece of that, is an adaptation to a constantly changing climate. And if you look at all of our cropping systems that are out there, and if you look at yield trends over time, that we have adapted to the types of things that are going on. And so, in this slowly changing environment, we can really figure out what to do. It's really these extreme events. It's the things that hit you up alongside the head that we really need to think about how we're going to cope with those as well. And so if we just look at this, Hansen and Sato and Rudy put a paper together in PANS back in 2012 that just talked about how the small shifts in a mean can cause a large increases in extreme events. And it just really plotted where we're at starting in 1951 to 80, and then 81 to 91, and 91 to 2000, and just looking at summer temperature anomalies. Is that if you just look at this and look at relative to this, is that these small increases in the temperature are going to increase the amount of extreme events that we have. And these extreme events are really what we need to think about looking at this. And we could plot these same thing for precipitation. We can plot it for both on the flip side and up and down on that, even in terms of frost as well. So it's not this gigantic shift that I think everybody is expecting out there, but just small shifts in our means can cause us lots of different issues. If you look at the National Climate Assessment, just four different graphs that are coming out of there, we're going to change the length of the frost-free season. You look across there as we're talking by, this is by 2100 on this, is that the upper Midwest and basically anything east of the Rockies, we're talking about 30 days longer in terms of a frost-free season. Number of frost days going down in there. But the interesting piece of that, if you run the projections in that, even though we've changed the length of the frost-free days and reduced the number of frost days, probability of frost still remains about the same. We can still get these extreme events that occur in there and have an impact. The lower left-hand corner in terms of consecutive dry days, number of increasing that, you look across Texas, Oklahoma, into Missouri, rainfall events going that are 9 days to 12 days between rainfall events. And if you could just add another 4 or 5 days to that, what you would have in terms of water stress on a plant. And then the number of hot nights as an event. Hot nights, we'll talk about this in terms of an extreme event, probably disrupt the physiology of biological systems more than anything else. And to put that into perspective for you, is just think about how you react when you're exposed to extremely hot nighttime temperatures. We don't cope very well with those because they disrupt our metabolic activity. They disrupt our capacity to rest. Same thing occurs when you talk about animals, you talk about plants and all of this. And so this change in the number of hot nights going to, in Iowa, to 40 hot nights in throughout the whole summer compared to what we have today is an extreme change in terms of the climate that's out there. But it's already occurring. The extreme events are already occurring out there in terms of what we look at, and we just use this simple little graph. We plot May, June precipitation versus July, August precipitation, spring versus summer. And if you take and look at this since 1893 through 2014, we put that date on there. And that oval circle around there is the 95% confidence limit of all the data, and you begin to see that 2008, 2012, 13, 10, 14, all those years have laid outside of the 95% confidence limit. And so you could look at those and say, we're already in a condition in which we have extreme events. And we see this changing across the system in such a way that we see a shifting seasonality of rainfall. We're seeing more and more spring rainfall, less summer rainfall. We see a lot of different things. In fact, it's become so dramatic that across the upper Midwest is that in that April through mid-May period, because we have more and more rainfall, is we've reduced the number of workable field days over that six-week period by 4 days. That's a pretty interesting shift in just the dynamics of the climate that's out there, and think about the disruption that that has in terms of the overall sequence of how we do farming operations. Just to show you, it's not an Iowa problem. This is actually Illinois as well. Again, May, June versus July, August, and you see all the recent years lay outside of that envelope of the rest of the data since 1895. And we can show you all the rest of the Midwestern states as well. Is that we've changed the overall dynamic of this system. And that slight disruption of just rainfall patterns and a reduction of the number of workable field days has caused some very interesting shifts in agriculture. Because of that shift, we see larger and larger planting equipment. We do have some 48-row planters across Iowa now that plants. We plant 1 million acres a day in the corn and soybean system in Iowa during planting season. But that's not the point that I want to make. The point I want to make is that shift in climate has not led to some efficient practices across the Midwest. We see an increasing amount of soil compaction. We see an increasing amount of poor stand establishment. We see an increasing amount of damage to the soil because we tend to work that soil too wet. And we work it too wet because it is wet. And so an adaptation strategy on this is really to get the producers to wait Unfortunately, producers don't wait. And so this is really because the number of different issues that go with that in all of this. Everybody remembers the summer of 2012 because that replaced the summer of 1988. 1988 was the drought year until 2012 came, and then now 2012 is our drought year. But in this collage of drought occurrences across the United States is that drought has occurred. And it takes little to disrupt this. And in fact, one of the major impacts on yields was not necessarily 2012, but 2013 across the Midwest. 2013 was the year of schizophrenic rainfall. Okay? We were really wet in the spring, really dry in the summer. Meteorologists coined that term, the flash drought that occurred, because we went from wet to dry in a short period of time. Farmers were so wet getting it in, and sometimes they didn't get it in. And then when they got it in, the plants were shallow rooted, and then when we went to drought, we ended up with lots of yield damage and lots of poor parts of the field that basically had a problem in terms of drought. So we ended up with both of those extremes in one year. And across that, and you look at that and say, what would you do for an adaptation strategy? In a lot of cases, the adaptation strategy of those producers was to claim prevented planted insurance. Because they did an economic analysis and said, with this crop insurance, I can make more money than if I try to put in a crop. So our adaptation strategy really became to use the government program to subsidize profitability or economic return rather than growing the crop. So you have to realize that we have a very interesting dynamic across the U.S. in terms of how do we think about coping with these systems as well. Missouri this year, 4 million acres of prevented planting across that. And we see that more and more as we look across that. We see another increase in terms of the changing cropping distribution, and that's a fact that we have a rise in what we call lost acres. The difference between planted and harvested acres are actually increasing in the last 5 years that are coincident with this changing rainfall pattern that we have out there with more spring, less precipitation, all this variation that's going on. Also, we see this other shift in the climate that's out there, and it's just a regression of the Palmer drought index, is that the Palmer index across the upper Midwest, and this is by cropping district now, is continuing to increase in there. So we're seeing all these different changes that occur. So we have all these backdrops that are out there. But let us put it into this perspective. When we talk about adaptation strategies for agriculture, is that we really need to think about the sequence in which producers really begin to do things. And this is a graph that Gene Talkley and a bunch of authors from the U2U project put together. And it really begins to look at this in a very complex way, and for the next 40 minutes when you stare at this, you can figure it all out. So really in a sequence, we'll just bring this together very quickly for you. As you look on the inside circle, it's on months. It's what producers really doing around those different months in there. And then you start looking at really what's going on in the outer circle and when they make different decisions. In February in terms of seed purchase, and then if you look at that over in terms of April, how they're putting that seed in the ground and how it's influenced by soil temperature and soil moisture. And if you don't do things, then you end up with compacted soil or wet soil and wet workable field days, if we talk about this, planting in terms of frost damage, late planting, and all of this. But at the outside of this circle is really where the climate begins to have a disruption in all of this. And you think about global seasonal changes. There's a lot of questions right now about what El Nino is going to do this year as well as next season. And so we're talking about short-term strategies and long-term strategies. And I think if we really want to think about effective adaptation practices, we have to understand the farmer calendar. The farmer calendar and where they're doing different things around these systems to be able to do this. Because the other piece of this in this lower right-hand corner is really about looking at the land tenure and land access to rentals and things like this. So there really is a very interesting process that we look at. But I want to bring your attention to the fact that let's also think about animals. Half of our economic return across the upper Midwest is an animal-based system as well as the crops of the other half. And the biggest piece of this puzzle is really about the temperature stresses. High nighttime temperatures on animals really cause a major disruption in this, and we compute a very simple index. It's a temperature humidity index. And you can all relate to it, because think about how you respond when there's high temperatures and high humidities. And animals do the same thing in terms of stresses. They place a great deal of stress on that animal. They take animals off of feed. They take animals out of egg production. They take animals out of beef, meat production and milk production. A sequence of 5 days of high temperatures in California in 2008, if I remember right, cost the dairy industry $32 million just on lost milk production. And that's an extreme event of a five-day duration. And so you look at all of this in terms of this, the economic impacts of this can be quite large, and we see the same thing in terms of other stresses as well. So the extreme events that we have in terms of crops really depends upon the stage of development. So we can't make a blanket statement and say, well, an extreme event is going to have the same economic impact or the same yield impact all the way through. Pollination is the most sensitive stage in terms of corn. High temperature event in there can basically sterilize this. We see the same thing in wheat, rice, even in cotton. Exposure to high temperatures during the reproductive stage, a lot more damaging than is the vegetative stage. Animals, depends upon whether they're in confined areas or they're on open range in terms of their exposure in this, because confined animals are actually a lot more sensitive to extreme events because of the inability to cool the barn. Precipitation always depends on the time of year of how we're going to adapt to that. That's why we spend a lot of time on the spring versus summer aspects of this and how does that whole sequence occur in terms of what we do. Frost depends upon the prior conditions. If it's been cold and we have a frost and plants aren't growing, there's really not an impact. I'll give you one example. This is 2012, and the example is tart cherries in Michigan. Everybody remembers the spring of 2012. Well, if you don't, I'll tell you. Spring of 2012 were extremely warm. Everything began to grow and bloom and everything else, and then we got hit with a late May frost. Wiped out 99.9% of the tart cherries in Michigan in one event. If you look at all the extremes that occur in terms of this, the biggest example is that a May freeze in 1945 basically took the apples and peaches out of Iowa because it was warm and it grew, and then we had a late spring frost, and now we've converted all that to corn and soybeans. But that one event took out the perennial crops. And that event, same thing in 2012, took out a lot of the apples that we continue to grow in Iowa and everything else. So it's complete loss of this in terms of that. High temperatures, like I said, in terms of this, depends upon the stage of development. But it interacts with soil water availability. We can have high water availability. We're going to have less sensitivity than if we that plant's already under water stress. But irrigation may not necessarily be the sole adaptation strategy that we can take to protect our plants from a lot of this. And these high temperature events, the one piece that often gets overlooked is the effect on evaporation rates. If we continue to evaporate water, the higher we increase the temperatures, the more water vapor demand, and the plants undergo stress very, very quickly. The high nighttime temperatures that we see in the climate trend are going to continue to add stress both to plants as well as animals in terms of the overall dynamics that are there. So this increasing temperature is going to increase the crop water demand because of this increasing water vapor deficit, which means we're going to have to think about how we manage the soils in order to maintain the maximum amount of water within that soil. Because a lot of the variation that we see within fields is really about water availability. And so the adaptation strategy really becomes of how do we manage the soil to protect against that. So then we get into this piece of adaptation versus mitigation. Because a lot of the soils pieces are really about mitigation in terms of improving carbon, improving soil water. Adaptation allows that biological system to avoid distress. The mitigation basically prepares the system to increase the resilience of the biological system. And if you think about it from that perspective, you begin to see how we interplay one against the other. Here's this simple graph in terms of improving organic matter relative to soil water holding capacity in that piece. Adaptation, animals, just shading that animal, just like you walk into the shade, how comfortable you are even though it's hot out there. Same thing occurs within the animal piece. Plants, adaptation in terms of planting dates to avoid frost at times, particularly some of our specialty crops. Selecting different maturity classes to avoid the timing of heat stress or even low water at the end of the season, and trying to avoid that complicating effect of water stress, either except or deficit. Perennials become a different piece of this. And so when we think about perennials rather to extreme temperature events, it's really how do we cool the plant to reduce the growth rate in all of this. And we see lots of cases when actually water is put in to basically cool that environment, to slow the rate of development in there. You have to have the water to invest in that from that standpoint. So the adaptation strategies that we are going to have to cope with extreme events are really going to take some imagination. There's a lot of different pieces that have to come with that to be able to draw the dynamics of all of these things together. So with that, Oscar.